So the outline of my talk, I will be talking first about the change in the epidemiology of cystic fibrosis. I'm going to talk about the characteristics of adult diagnosed cystic fibrosis and refer to some specific genotypes that is attached with this specific phenotype. And then I'm going to discuss with you the how to recognize and diagnose cystic fibrosis and cystic fibrosis-related disorders. So there has been a huge change in the epidemiology of cystic fibrosis. We know that the survival of patients with cystic fibrosis has improved dramatically. And the median age of survival is now at least 41 years. And about 50% of the U.S. persons with cystic fibrosis are now adults. And this is based on the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation patient registry that was published in 2012. Now, this graph from the same registry looks at the number of children and adults with cystic fibrosis between the years 1986 and 2012. And the blue line represents the adults, while the green line represents the children. And what you can see here that around 30% of the patients with cystic fibrosis actually were adults in 1986. However, in 2012, this proportion came up. It's now 50% of the patients with cystic fibrosis in 2012 are actually adults. So what that means is that cystic fibrosis patients with TOM are becoming healthier and they are living longer. And this is really important because one of the reasons why they are really we're noticing this change in epidemiology is because of the improvement in health system and improvement in current medications and current treatment protocols. But part of it, and to a lesser extent, is related due to a new phenotype of asthma that we're noticing lately. And this is the phenotype that tend to present during adulthood. And I think this is of interest for all internists and adult pulmonologists. This is another graph from the same registry, and it looks at the age at diagnosis of all people with cystic fibrosis in year 2012. And as you can see here, that most, around 90% of patients with cystic fibrosis are usually diagnosed while they're kids. However, there is a group developing that the age of diagnosis is going up, starting from the age 16 years and above. And this is, again, the interest of, or the focus of this lecture. Now, this is a group from University of Columbia who really got interested in this particular group of cystic fibrosis that tend to have a late onset of diagnosis. And what they've noticed that 8.3% of the new cystic fibrosis diagnosed in US cystic fibrosis patients were made at the age of 18 or above. Between a decade, you know, over a decade between 1995 and 2005. And what they noticed also that the proportion of the CF diagnosis occurring after the age of 18 years is increasing with time. So the first half of this decade, the proportion was around 7.7% and increased to 9% in the second half of the decade. Now, we don't really know how is the newborn screening for cystic fibrosis will or might have affected this in the past, because the newborn screening is not really available globally, and it's not available globally even within a big country, for example, like the United States. But what I would like to say that with time we will be able to see, we will be able to differentiate certain group of patients are coming and presenting at a later age with signs and symptoms that are not necessarily typical for cystic fibrosis, but then they are actually CF patients. So before going on about characterizing the patients with atypical presentation with cystic fibrosis, I'm just going to review quickly with you what are the classical presentation for cystic fibrosis. We know that patients with cystic fibrosis present with severe recurrent airway infections leading to bronchiectasis, decline in lung function, and eventually pulmonary insufficiency. And we know also that about 90% of patients with the classic CF have a pancreatic exocrine dysfunction. most of those patients are on pancreatic enzymes. And we also know that the sweat chloride concentration on those patients with the classic CF is usually high. It's above 60 millimole per liter. And we know that most of those children or adults, you know, that have a classic cystic fibrosis have a chronic sinus disease. And about 99% of the patients with classic cystic fibrosis, the males in this group, have male infertility. And this is due to obstructive azoospermia. And this is, of course, related to the congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens. So it is not enough to establish diagnosis based on organ involvement or in phenotype. We have also to establish CF diagnosis based on a lab evidence that shows a CFTR dysfunction. CFTR stands for cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. And this is the protein that regulates the chloride traffic, and it's one of the most important protein involved in cystic fibrosis. And for establishing this lab evidence of CFTR dysfunction, we have to have either elevated sweat chloride concentration above 60 millimoles per liter or non-CF mutation in both alleles that is known to cause a CFTR dysfunction. Now, in some cases, even with the classic cystic fibrosis, things are a little grayish or murky. And to establish this evidence of CFTR dysfunction, in the absence of a conclusive sweat chloride test, sometimes we have to end up using a lab test called nasal potential difference. Nasal potential difference is a very sophisticated test, and there are few areas or centers in the world that can do it. However, it seems that we cannot really depend on sweat chloride test for establishing diagnosis of CF when we are talking about patients who are presenting at a later age. And this is a group that looked, and they were interested specifically on this group of patients, and they found collectively that around 25% of patients who are diagnosed during adulthood either having indeterminate sweat chloride levels like between 40 and 60 millimoles per liter or normal below 30 millimoles per liter. Specifically, 13.6% of the patients who were diagnosed above 18 years of age have indeterminate sweat chloride levels compared to only 3.2% in the patients who were diagnosed below 12 years of age. And that also goes for normal sweat chloride. It was found that around 10.7% of the patients who were diagnosed above 18 years of age had a normal sweat chloride compared to 4.1% in the patients who were diagnosed below 12 years of age. Now, the European CF Diagnostic Group in 2006 published this algorithm, and actually multiple algorithms in the journal Thorax. And they're really, really very useful algorithms that can take you step by step about establishing the diagnosis of CF, whether it is a classic or non-classic. And I really encourage most of you to take a look at this because it's really easy to follow. However, I would like to just to summarize it for you. In the case of typical or classic cystic fibrosis, with the involvement of at least one phenotypic characteristics, we need an establishment of a CFTR dysfunction proof, and in this case, the sweat chloride concentration above 60 millimoles per liter. Now, practically, we are doing genotypes on all children with cystic fibrosis, and this has multiple functions. The first function, it has a prognostic values depending on the type of mutation. The other thing, now with the advent of new revolutionary medicines, some of the medicines are really directed to specific mutation, and I think this next speaker will be elaborating more about this. Now, in the case of atypical or non-classic cystic fibrosis, where there are usually one or more organ involvement, and what you would notice usually is a normal or borderline sweat chloride concentration between 30 and 60 millimoles per liter. So the diagnosis may require the detection of one disease-causing mutation in each CFTR gene or direct quantification of CFTR dysfunction by using the alternative method to sweat chloride, which is the nasal potential difference. Now, before I go further about the specific genotyping in the atypical cystic fibrosis, CFTR mutations are usually classified into six classes. The first class, and then when there is no CFTR protein really expressed at the level of the nucleus and the mRNA. And class two is when the CFTR, which is misfolded, doesn't really reach the membrane to act at all. And one of the common mutation for this is Delta 508, which is the most common mutation in a classic CF for patients of Caucasian ancestry. And then we have a class three in which the protein is made and it travels and it's represented in the membrane. However, there is a gating defect. It doesn't really allow the chloride to traffic through it. And one of the most common mutations for it is the G551D. Again, this is a mutation for which a new medicine called Ivacaftor has been created and which is making a huge change in the life of those cystic fibrosis patients. Class four, it is when the CFTR has been made, it's folded, it's packaged, and it's trafficking all the way to the surface. However, the pore is restrictive in terms of what it allows, in terms of chloride ions going through it. And it's called a conductance, actually, defect, conductance defect. And the commonest and one of the known mutations with this is the R117H. And this R117H is one of the main mutations that has changed the face of cystic fibrosis and making it milder and presenting at a later age. And then we have a class five. And the class five in which everything is really normal, but there isn't really enough coming out of the nucleus in terms of CFTR. And class six, in which everything is normal, CFTR is produced, packaged, folded, and all the way it reaches to the surface. However, it is unstable on the surface. Then it's internalized and recycled into different pathways. So from all the classes of CFTR that I have mentioned to you, we have the classes like three and four, in which the CFTR is restrictive in terms of what it allows through in terms of chloride ions. And the other one in terms, we have functional CFTRs, but there are not enough of them, basically. Now, this is a group from Denver, Colorado, in the States. And it noticed that CF patients diagnosed in adulthood are more likely to be pancreatic sufficient than patients diagnosed in childhood. Around 50% of the patients who were diagnosed during adulthood were pancreatic sufficient compared to 21% of the patients who were diagnosed during childhood. And they found that it's more likely to have a residual function mutation, a mutation that allows some function of the CFTR to be reserved in around 70% of the patients who were diagnosed during adulthood compared to 7.7% in the patients who were diagnosed in childhood. And those residual function mutation were found to be R117H, 3849 plus 10 kBC to T, and the D1152H. But when you look at pancreatic sufficiency in cystic fibrosis and compare it depending on which classes of mutations we have, the patients who had pancreatic insufficient cystic fibrosis, the classic CF, basically had either class one mutation where there is no synthesis of CFTR, class two where there is a block in the processing, or a class three in where there is a block in regulation like the gating mutation. However, the patient with non-classic cystic fibrosis in which the pancreatic exocrine function is preserved, they either have a class four in which there is an altered conductance, a conductance defect, or a reduce in the synthesis like in a class four and a class five. So where do we go from here in terms of clinical presentation? So most patients with adult diagnosis cystic fibrosis are less likely to have pancreatic insufficiency. They are less likely to have fat malabsorption syndromes in terms like steatorrhea and similar presenting symptoms or signs. However, they are more likely to have respiratory symptoms already established at time of diagnosis, unlike the classic cystic fibrosis, where in the first few months of life, it's rarely to see respiratory symptom and it's more GI symptoms that are dominant. However, these respiratory symptoms are milder, and it's not unusual at all. It's very common to see the sputum growing, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, or non-tuberculous mycobacteria at time of diagnosis during adulthood. And in some cases, the cystic fibrosis patients who are diagnosed during adulthood can present only with one organ involvement. An example of this is the idiopathic pancreatitis and male infertility. And I'm going to elaborate a little bit about this in the coming few slides. So I mentioned to you, patients with cystic fibrosis who are diagnosed during adulthood tend to have pulmonary disease. However, the pulmonary disease is milder than what we expect. And this is also true in terms of lung functions. This is a study that looked at, or two studies that looked at, if FEV1 expressed as percent predicted at the age of 40 years based on the fact that either the patient was diagnosed during adulthood or during childhood. And in this report, around the FEV1 was 57.9% predicted in the patient with adult diagnosis compared to 50% predicted in patients with the childhood diagnosis. And in this report, FEV1 was 60% predicted compared to in the patients with adult diagnosis compared to 45% predicted when the diagnosis was done during childhood. I mentioned to you about the specific sputum microbiology in adult diagnosis, and here's the data. Around 50.7% of the patients who were diagnosed above 18 years of age had an evidence of Pseudomonas aeruginosa at the time of diagnosis compared to 27.1% for the patients who were diagnosed below 12 years of age. And that goes also for non-tuberculous mycobacteria. Around 4.6% were found at the time of diagnosis for patients diagnosed during adulthood compared to 0.1% when the diagnosis was done during childhood. This also goes for sinus disease. Around 16% of the patients who were diagnosed during adulthood have an established sinus disease at time of diagnosis, compared to 2.6% in patients who were diagnosed during childhood. Now, what would set us off even further is when we have a patient presenting with one organ involvement in case of cystic fibrosis. And this is true in two cases, like the diagnosis of idiopathic pancreatitis and male infertility because of congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens. Now, in the case of idiopathic pancreatitis, the connection with atypical cystic fibrosis was reported in 1998 by these two reports that came up in the New England Journal of Medicine. And these two reports found that around 10 to 15% of the patients with idiopathic pancreatitis have mild cystic fibrosis. And in both reports, they found that between 20% to 37% of the patients with idiopathic pancreatitis, again, those patients don't have any other cause for pancreatitis. They're not alcoholic, they don't drink alcohol, and they don't have gallstone or pancreatic or gallstone disease. Around 20 to 37% of those patients with idiopathic pancreatitis had at least one CF mutations, and 7 to 11% of those patients had at least two CF mutations. What we know about the CF accompanying signs and symptoms in this group of patients, that they are pancreatic sufficient, and they have mild lung disease, and they tend to have a normal sweat chloride test. And even when you do a nasal potential difference, you see only an intermediate result, which means that the CFTR function is preserved enough to preserve all of the other functions and masking the CFTR dysfunction phenotype. In case of male infertility, secondary to congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens, the association with CFTR was reported in the early 1990. It's 1 in 1,000 in its prevalence, and around 70 to 90% of those patients have two CFTR mutations. And the common CFTR mutations that are associated with this type of one involvement with male infertility is the 5T and the R117H. Now, just to make it a little bit clearer, because I get a lot of questions about these mutations. Now, there are specific mutations in cystic fibrosis, and those mutations are known to modulate or change the phase of the classic cystic fibrosis. And one of them is 5T mutation, which is known as a splicing mutation or causing splicing abnormality. So when you have a mutation that causes a classic cystic fibrosis, for example, Delta 508, Delta 508 is known to give us the whole panel of cystic fibrosis, sinus disease, pulmonary disease, pancreatic exocrine dysfunction, you name it, everything. But when you, when the other allele has the 5T mutation, the results are different. You can have 40% with no disease at all, 60% with just male infertility, and less than 1% have really mild cystic fibrosis. So 5T, when it is heterozygously combined with a very classic mutations like Delta 508, it changes really the outcome. The other mutation of interest is the R117H. And it's known that the phenotype is really milder with R117H, and it's mainly dependent on the accompanying T allele that causes a splicing of the CFTR. So if R117H is linked to a 5T mutation, most of those patients will present only with pancreatic sufficient cystic fibrosis. However, if the association is with 7T, you will end up having a mild CFTR dysfunction, like one organ involvement, like idiopathic pancreatitis or male infertility. However, we know that this group mild might progress over time, so it's extremely important to keep following those patients. So far, I showed you that we have different mutations, different presentation, and it's all dependent on how much CFTR is functioning. So in the case when you have non-carriers, when you have a wild type, like normal people, we have CFTR functioning in 100% of the time, and there's no disease as expected. When you have carriers, CFTR is functioning, 50% of the CFTR is functioning. And again, this is enough to cause no disease. When you have these mutations that are known to cause a milder disease, like the homozygous 5T or the R117H7T, CFTR function is preserved by around 10%. And most of those patients will present either with male infertility or with idiopathic pancreatitis plus minus sinusitis. If we have the class 4 or a class 5 mutation, then CFTR function is preserved only by 4%, and most of those patients will present with lung disease. However, the pancreatic exocrine function is preserved and they don't have much of GI symptoms. If the class is 1, 2, and 3, and we know those classes don't give us enough CFTR, or we have a gating defect, only 1% of the CFTR function is preserved, and the pancreatic insufficiency is the main presentation with lung disease like a classic cystic fibrosis. So accordingly, CF diagnosis is based basically on three main categories. As well, we have the classic CF, where we have a high sweat chloride and two non-CF mutations, not including the 5T and the R117H. And then we have a CFTR-related disorders, in which we have a sweat chloride intermediate, we have a CFTR-related disorder gene, and often one single organ involvement. And then in the cases when we have low sweat chloride, normal sweat chloride levels, and no CF or CFTR-related disorders, unlikely that we have cystic fibrosis in those patients. So when to suspect cystic fibrosis? Especially when they are presenting at an older age. We suspect CF if the patient has bronchiectasis and one of the following. They have some degree of lung disease and one of the following. They have recurrent unexplained pancreatitis, case of male infertility, and recurrent nasal polyposis. Other warning signs is when the sputum production, with sputum cultures, shows mainly NTMs, non-tuberculous mycobacterium, specifically Mycobacterium avium complex. Or they have allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, and it's not uncommon to have both of them at the same time. Bronchiectasis in CF typically present in the upper lobes and will be diffused later on. However, cystic bronchiectasis presenting in the lower lobe is unlikely linked to cystic fibrosis. And we see it more with patients with immune dysfunction, like the common variable immune deficiency, or with certain ciliopathies, like primary ciliary dyskinesia. And bronchiectasis presenting in the middle lobe or lingula is typical for Mycobacterium avium complex. Proximal, cylindrical, and central bronchiectasis is more common with allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. So what to do if you suspect CF? The first thing to do is to establish some CFTR dysfunction evidence, like the sweat chloride. And then you do the panel of the most common mutation from the population this patient is coming. So if the sweat chloride is above 60, or we have two mutations that are typical for production of CFTR dysfunction, then this is cystic fibrosis. But however, if the genotype is not really very helpful, then you have to do perform extensive mutation analysis and look for another lab evidence for CFTR dysfunction, like the nasal potential difference, if the sweat chloride is intermediate or normal. However, if the sweat chloride is normal, below 30 millimoles, zero mutations, this is unlikely cystic fibrosis or CF-related disorder. Now, in this part of the world, in the Middle East and the Arab world, I think it's very important to really open eyes about this specific group of cystic fibrosis that have milder disease and who tend actually to present during adulthood. The reason why, because we tend to have different mutations. And then there is the consanguinity issue in our families and in some of our cultures. To give you an example, when just I left my practice in the States and after seeing hundreds of patients with classic cystic fibrosis, I moved to practice into Qatar and I found there 50 children with the diagnosis of cystic fibrosis. And they were approached and treated as classic cystic fibrosis. And the first thing that I noticed is that they don't have pancreatic insufficiency. Most of them don't have malabsorption, and all of them. They tend to present with pseudobarter syndrome. They have a sinus disease. Infertility is not common in all of them. And there is no evidence of GI malabsorption. And they have a specific mutation that till now we don't know if it causes a CFTR dysfunction. And you can go ahead and, you know, establish similar stories all over the Arab world. So I think it's very important for registries, for people like us who are trying to establish registries, is to notice this and be focused a little bit about those patients with atypical presentations. I'm going to stop here, and thank you for your kind attention.